This is Eleanor Swent, continuing an interview with Frank Joklik. This is February 22nd, 1994, and we're in Salt Lake City.
Okay.
Well, we should talk a little bit then about the fruits of exploration and development since I took over here in Salt Lake at the presidency of Kennecott. And this is the third element of the strategy that we involved in 1980, the other two being first the cost reduction without major capital investment, then the major capital investments that led to the modernization of the mine, the concentrator, the smelter, and the refinery. And then the third element now is the search for new properties, for new operations. And what I think what drives this in any mining company is the knowledge that the resources that are being mined are being depleted and will run out one day, and that to maintain a viable and profitable enterprise, it is necessary to discover and bring on stream new ore deposits. I tend to look into the future anyway. That's not something that I have to force myself to do. I'm always concerned about the opportunities and problems of tomorrow. And
of course, as an exploration geologist, this was your field anyhow.
That fits right in. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I've also never been a disciple of taking refuge in the quote core business. You know, these fads in management come mm-hmm. and go, and the last few years we've seen company after company discover the virtue of re-emphasizing the core business. And you can be sure that as the U.S. and worldwide economy improve, the discovery will be made that one should diversify from the core business, and there'll be another vogue of diversification. So these mm-hmm. things go in cycles. But discovering the core business again, I think, just indicates that probably the core business has been neglected, as was the case with Kennecott before the 1980s, and led to a lot of the problems that were encountered when Kennecott couldn't cope with the decline in copper prices. There's another consideration that, Bingham Canyon has now been set on a course that will ensure continued operations until the reserves of Bingham Canyon are exhausted. And that will be in about 30 years' time. I mean, what we've done with the modernization of the facilities here and the cost reductions of the early 80s, we've ensured that the company will survive dips in prices. I mean, at 300,000 tons a year of copper, 1 cent decline in prices is $6 million. And if after modernization we figured that cash costs of production were in the range of 30 to 40 cents a pound, it would take a decline in prices right down to that level to endanger the operation. And I don't see prices declining to that level despite the fact that there's much new capacity coming on stream, particularly in South America, which will be relatively low price consumption, particularly the operations that depend on solvent extraction electrowinning technology applied to large reserves of oxidized ore. So I think Bingham Canyon will continue to operate profitably, but the end will come when the ore reserves are exhausted in 30 years' time, and the question is, what then? If it's a matter of dividending out the profits over that period to the shareholders and then closing up shop, that's certainly one strategy, and it could be a happy ending to the story. On the other hand, if the expertise gained in the operation has in the meantime been applied to acquiring or discovering and bringing into production major other mineral deposits, then the company will continue in business. I've always felt that exploration is a cost of doing business in the mining industry, because I do believe that the expertise of profitably operating a mine can be applied to analogous situations elsewhere to expand and diversify. This is not entirely obvious at all times. I mean, there are some companies in operation which really just concentrate on mining out the known ore deposits and don't give much thought to the future. But I've always felt that during thick times and thin, a certain proportion of earnings applied to exploration is a worthwhile endeavor that can lead to good results for the shareholders financially. You know, Kennecott had been through many attempts to diversify during its history. If you take the, closest to home, if you take the ventures to go into fabricating, you had the Okanite, you had Kennecott Wire and Cable, both of which really ran into antitrust problems and had to be divested by the company. Peabody was a rather short-lived attempt to get into the coal business in a big way, but that again ran into the problems of the antitrust laws, and divestiture had to be made at a loss if you take into account inflation during the period of ownership. Carborundum didn't work out. During an earlier period, there was one attempt to get into oil and gas, another one into South African gold. none of these really led to success.
Of course, there were the Latin American adventures also.
Well, you mean El Teniente? Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but that was...
That was a political
situation. Yeah, but even before El Teniente was divested, it had returned the investment several times mm-hmm. over. So, it was...
But the end was because of a political situation more
right.
than anything else.
And it didn't really... Yeah, when first the partial divestiture and then the forced divestiture of the rest during the Allende regime, there was some compensation paid afterwards. I think we've mm-hmm. already alluded to that.
Right.
But it wasn't really a diversification from porphyry copper mining.
No, it was still porphyry copper.
So we did maintain a... exploration program during the difficult years of the late 1970s and the 80s. Of course, we had these various periods of ownership which influenced the level of expenditure at various points during the 1970s, 80s, and early 1990s. First was the acquisition of Kennecott by Standard Oil. Standard Oil paid $1.7 billion for Kennecott in 1981, and increasingly viewed exploration with a jaundiced eye, but we did not give up altogether by any means. And then in 1987, BP bought the portion of Standard Oil that they didn't own already, so they began to have an influence on the rate of expenditure on exploration. And then finally, the acquisition of BP's mineral business by RTZ in 1989. And RTZ, being a mining company, of course, understood the desirability of a reasonable level of expenditure on exploration. And I keep on talking about the level. The level of exploration is anything from $4 or $5 million a year to $15 million a year. That is about the range of expenditure.
I would think that the oil companies would be very exploration-minded. They have
Oh, they were, but exploration for oil
for
and gas.
Oil. Right.
Yeah.
But not for minerals.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we're talking about the period here, Lee, when Standard Oil cranked its domestic exploration up from virtually zero to a level of $1 billion a year. This is what happened in the early 80s, largely driven by Tom Barrow. And then you had first the failure of the exploration in Alaska, when the Muckluck, M-U-K-L-U-K, when the Muckluck well failed. I haven't talked about that, have I?
No.
You see, the level of exploration for oil and gas rose, and they opened several offices in the lower 48, and brought in some excellent people who had the best seismic and other exploration technology at their disposal, and the idea was to find an analog, or to find a second Prudhoe Bay. And Muckluck which was just offshore from Prudhoe Bay, gave all signs of having the same characteristics as an oil reservoir. And it was perhaps touted is the wrong word, but it was success was anticipated very intensely. And when that well, which cost something like $300 or $400 million, proved to be dry, because there had been at some stage a conditions of temperature and pressure that caused the hydrocarbons, the liquid hydrocarbons, to migrate, and that proved to be dry. I believe that was in 83.
Must have been a terrible disappointment.
Yeah, that was a disappointment, and really, it was the beginning of questions at the Standard Oil board level. I attended a lot of those meetings, where some of the directors said, what is the return on this investment of up to $1 billion a year in exploration? What is the return on the investment? It was, well, the answer might have been too early to tell, but when you've been doing that for a number of years, you do expect to start seeing successes. Muckluck was supposed to put directors at ease and illustrate to them that, by golly, there was going to be a good return from the expenditure of all these monies. So after that, the rate of expenditures on oil and gas by Standard Oil decreased, but until then, money for minerals exploration was very hard to come by, because it was all going into oil and gas, and that really continued right throughout the ownership by Standard Oil. Well, to get more specific now about what the situation was when I was appointed as president of Kennecott, there had been about 80% or 90% of expenditures, and some of this under my direction, because when I rejoined Kennecott in 1974, the exploration program was just about 100% for porphyry coppers, and Kennecott had developed technological expertise in exploration for porphyry coppers that was second to none. But the fruits of that program were pretty meager. Much porphyry copper mineralization had been found, but not of grades and mining characteristics that would lead to economic operations. So and one of the largest deposits, one of the largest porphyry copper deposits found was at Safford in Arizona, and that had become the target of investigation as an in situ mining site. In situ technology being a process of injecting lixiviants into the deposit through boreholes and extracting the copper enriched solutions through recovery wells and then precipitating the dissolved copper by solvent extraction and electrowinning.
This was a very exciting new possibility, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was partly kibitzed from the oil companies. Mm. Petroleum reservoir geology was applied to devising the in situ mining technology, and Kennecott had spent $20 or $25 million at Safford.
It was to be safer and cleaner and the answer to many problems, you're right, wasn't it?
There were great expectations mm-hmm. for it. But when I first looked at it, I began to worry about the vagaries of Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
It was the world of difference between the liquid dynamics of a oil reservoir in relatively undisturbed in a relatively undisturbed geological environment and a porphyry copper environment, which has been the scene of violent intrusion and several epochs of fracturing and faulting. And I said to myself, why should the lixiviants, once pumped down there, saturate or permeate the porphyry copper ore body and dissolve a substantial proportion of the copper in the rocks? Why shouldn't those lixiviants just follow the easiest path with the lowest potential and follow three or four major fractures and then be picked up in the recovery well without having contacted any appreciable proportion of the copper mineralization? And when we started to really look at that and conduct some controlled experiments of injections and recovery, we found that that's exactly what was happening, and the project was abandoned. The other non-porphyry copper project that Kennecott had put a lot of money into was what I had started many years before, which was the Ocean Nodule Project.
Mm-hmm.
And the law of the and a lot of Kennecott money had gone into developing the gathering, recovery, transportation and treatment of this material towards making a commercial operation out of it, or an economically profitable operation out of it. And what stopped that one in the end were the difficulties surrounding the law of the sea negotiations. It just it did not seem that at any time in the foreseeable future it would be possible to obtain title to ore body, if you like, on the seafloor, and have the right to explore, the right to develop it and operate it and obtain a return on the very considerable investment.
So it wasn't a technical problem there?
Not really,
no.
Lee. I don't think so. I think that certainly during the stronger phases in the price cycle, a case could be made that a return on investment was to be expected. So, in 1980, then we had this, we had these abandoned projects behind us. We had a foreseeable period of low copper prices ahead of us. And we decided to continue with exploration for precious metals.
Now, Standard Oil didn't come in till 81.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct, yes.
You said just now in 1980.
Yeah. Well, I took over in 1980.
Correct, yes. And the Safford in situ project?
That was all prior to that.
That was before then. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was
yeah.
before
by
Standard
then,
Oil.
By then we had stopped Safford and the in situ.
But the technology came from oil, but not because you were owned
no,
by Standard
I'm sorry,
oil.
That
okay.
was misleading.
Okay.
No, that was borrowed from the oil industry way before Standard Oil came into
okay.
the picture.
All right. You were not borrowing within divisions of the company.
It wasn't a case of synergy, which is,
no.
of course, always the rationale for any
That's
kind
what
of merger
you hope
or
for.
Whatever. Yeah.
Okay. So you had tried these, and they had not worked, and then, so now you decided to just stick with porphyry copper.
Well, as you know, during the No, not really.
Wasn't that simple?
No.
right.
What I said was we see, the porphyry copper exploration, as I said, had discovered a lot of porphyry copper ore, but had not led to the discovery of large, high-grade, potentially economic deposits. And the outlook for copper prices in 1980 was poor, so we did not continue with porphyry copper
okay.
exploration. This had been the long-standing Kennecott philosophy of you can look for anything as long as it's copper. My exploration philosophy is of a more opportunistic and flexible nature. I've always believed that there shouldn't really be any bar to what commodity you explored for, as long as the understanding was that you would try to find truly low-cost resources. Because so often commodity forecasts are wrong anyway. and you find that there's a resurgence in prices. After a period when a certain commodity may have been in disrepute because of a long extended period of low prices. But as long as you find one of the largest, highest grade, lowest cost deposits of that commodity, you usually come out a winner in the long run.
Now, I read a very important presentation that you made to your department, your division, about this philosophy. Did you also have to sell it to the board? Did you have to sell it upwards as well as downward?
Oh, yes, certainly. You know, Kennecott, before it was acquired by Standard Oil, then Standard Oil and BP, all had policies of exposing management people to the board periodically. Mm-hmm. And this contrasted with the RTZ style, where local directors in London carried the message of the board, or their version of it, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
But both with Kennecott when they were independent and when we were still independent, and with the oil companies, you were generally stuck with selling your story directly to the board.
Mm-hmm.
Another another part of my exploration philosophy has always been that you can't force Mother Nature into strict parameters which are then rigidly transferable from one geographic location to another. By all means, you can learn from one occurrence and apply those ideas elsewhere, but I sometimes saw exploration projects being abandoned because they didn't exactly fit someone's preconception of what parameters ought to be found in this new location. And then somebody else comes along without such prejudices and, you know,
can you give a concrete example?
Is a little bit more flexible and just drills a few holes in there. What I'm trying to think of the most famous ones of all wasn't it Thomas Edison finding Sudbury nickel, where someone had drilled before and had said, well, this doesn't quite fit my...
But were there any in your experience where you people abandoned things that later were...
Yeah, well, sure, actually, right in the... you know, in one of Khrushchev's, for instance, was which I'm going to be talking about, was a case where the geological model that had been applied by the company that had the property turned out to be wrong.
Okay.
In fact, it tends to apply to most deposits,
mm-hmm,
that are not pure virgin discoveries, because someone else has been there before and done either some surface prospecting or some drilling with some concepts in mind and abandoned the property, and then next person comes along and does things a bit differently, and lo and behold, there's the discovery.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be talking about the gold mines that we found, and that's the case in just about every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The one commodity that we found did play well with the oil companies once we got into those years when Kennecott was no longer an independent company, was precious metals. Not that we began the search for gold and silver then. That search had actually begun a couple of years before. In 1979, we initiated the exploration program for gold. But with the decline in precious metal prices, base metal prices, particularly gold. Look, I'm losing it here. Particularly copper, I mean. And the strengthening of precious metal prices, both gold and silver, which happened in 1980-81, we switched a substantial proportion of the exploration budget into precious metals. And the outcome of that, briefly put, was the discovery of five precious metal ore bodies, which were either developed into mines, one was sold, and Lihir, which I'll talk about in a minute, is still in the early stages of development. So let me just talk a little bit about those five mm-hmm. precious metal discoveries. Then I'll talk about two mines that we, or at least two properties that we inherited when we became responsible for BP's North American exploration program. And then finally I'll talk about three other acquisitions or diversifications into commodities other than precious and base metals, namely coal and diamonds. And the third one being uranium.
Okay. So that's a total of 10. It's a lot.
Yes. Perhaps we could just switch off for one.
And this is 79. 80?
Yeah. The first of the five that I want to talk about is the discovery of the Alacran, A-L-A-C-R-A-N.
Mm-hmm. Scorpion.
The Scorpion vein in the Bolaños, B-O-L-A-N-O-S, mining district in, I believe it's in Jalisco, J-A-L-I-S-C-O,
mm-hmm.
About the 80 miles north of Guadalajara. We had begun to look at Mexico in, I believe it was in 1978, and examined several mining prospects. You see, at that time, very few foreign mining companies were active in Mexico because of largely unsatisfactory experiences in the past and the requirement for 51% Mexican ownership. But the geology was not prejudiced by such political considerations, and we decided to go in there.
There was considerable terrorism at that time in
there was some,
Mexico.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. In this old mining district of Bolaños, the Spaniards had operated, I believe, in the early 18th century with, to put it politely, indentured labor.
Mm.
And they mined the high-grade out of the veins which occurred in a series of major faults in the sequence of volcanic rocks. They mined material that ran 200 ounces to the ton and took it by mule train 400 miles to the Atlantic coast, and then shipped it to Spain for recovery of the silver.
This was gold and silver?
No, just silver.
Just
this
silver.
Is a silver mining district.
Okay.
In this little town of Bolaños itself, or this little town of Bolaños served as the as a sort of provincial capital, and the governor's mansion, which dated from the 17th century, had become the headquarters of a small company owned by the Davila family, with whom we signed an agreement in 1979. And I remember my first visit there, staying in the governor's mansion, the walls about 18 inches thick, and all the doorways beautifully fluted. It was a architectural masterpiece, really sere countryside, very rugged terrain, and the people living in these little towns, which were in most places connected only by foot trails, eked out a living on the steep slopes, growing whatever crops they could, mostly beans.
Corn.
And corn, mm-hmm. precisely. Well, you know it.
You've, yeah. How you've, did you get into Bolaños? Was there a railroad or a train?
No, they had a strip there, an airstrip, which was about the width of a normal road, say about 20 feet wide, and it was undulating.
Oh, yeah.
And had a stone wall on the end. And on one occasion, I wasn't in the plane, but the guy on takeoff sheared off the, he hadn't had the wheels up yet, but of course when he came to the stone wall, it sheared off the landing gear.
Oh.
The landings there were always quite interesting because usually very hot and turbulent conditions. Mm. So we.
What kind of planes were you using?
Oh, just single-engined Pipers or Cessnas.
Mm-hmm. From Guadalajara?
From Guadalajara, mm-hmm. it's about an hour's flight.
Mm-hmm.
But the peasants there, the inhabitants of the villages were really hardy folk, made excellent mine workers.
Mm-hmm. Hard workers.
Yeah, hard workers. And I remember my first visit there was we're driving along the road from the airstrip to the mine, and please, I'll call her back. Thank you. And we encountered this a very bumpy ride, but the thing that stuck in my mind was this peasant with a sombrero, and he was leading a donkey, and his wife and little child were on the donkey. And you know, for a minute it reminded you of the flight from Egypt.
Sounds biblical. How did you find this prospect? Did your geologist find it, or was it brought to you?
No, our geologist found it, yeah. Well, we had, you know, targeted this as an area in which we'd like to examine a number of prospects,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of them. After the Spaniards, the Cornish had mined there, and then early in the century, American mm-hmm. company had mined there too. The ore that was left was not bonanza grade. It ran between 5 and 10 ounces. And our acquisition of the property was based on the premise that we would expand the concentrator, which existed there, a 500 ton a day concentrator. We'd expand it to 1,000 tons a day and feed it with this somewhat lower grade mineralization. Mm. Now, our agreement with the Davilas was made when the price of silver was 20 ounces to the ton in 1979, and on the way down, I think it was. In effect, of course, silver declined to $4 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
And we found ourselves losing money in the operation, and apart from that, of course, we'd sunk the money for the expansion to 1,000 tons a day into it.
Mm-hmm.
We had as manager a young man, Alfredo Parra, a product of one of the excellent mining schools in Mexico, an outstanding young mining engineer. And he had a very good workforce. But
you said the price fell from 20 to 4.
Yeah.
That's was $20.
Right. $20 an ounce, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Down to $4.
Down to 4. Okay, well, that's a significant drop.
Well, yeah, so we found ourselves losing money from the operation.
Mm-hmm.
We had financed the mill expansion and now financing the operating losses separately,
mm-hmm,
by means of bank loans. And
you had only 49%.
We had 49%, but 11% had been put into escrow,
mm-hmm,
so that we had effective control.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the interesting part of this was that by then the oil company, Standard Oil, was beginning to look at this money-losing operation very critically. I was going down there once a month to try to salvage what could be salvaged, but the one thing we insisted on was that exploration in the area for a vein that the Spaniards might have missed would continue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lo and behold, in October of 1983, by which time we were about $30 million in the hole, the third hole drilled into the Alacran vein that we had discovered hit 4 meters running 70 ounces for the ton. What we did then was to drill another 15 or 16 holes from the surface, all deep holes, very difficult drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And on the basis of the ore reserve outline from this drilling, we put in an adit 1 mile long to intersect this vein, hopefully beneath the main ore body, to speed driving the adit, we got a contractor from Cleveland and bored the adit rather than conventional drifting, which would have taken 3 or 4 times as long.
This is through volcanic rock?
Through the country rock to 1 mile to intersect the vein.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you can imagine, Lee, this was a pretty feisty strategy to put in a 1 mile adit on the basis of 16 surface drill holes,
mm-hmm,
and hope to hit it just right. But we were under considerable pressure because our results from Bolaños to date were beginning to cause some pretty loud criticism from our owners. The time approached when the drift should have intersected the vein, and it did. We found quartz and altered minerals, and if I remember rightly, 2 or 3 ounces of silver.
Oh.
So we puckered up and we said, maybe all is not lost. We will raise from the adit and see whether the high-grade mineralization is within reach. So that's exactly what we did. We raised about 15 meters. Well, it was only about 10 meters, I guess, and ran smack into the keel of the high-grade mineralization.
Party time.
Well, it was party time. Our relationships with the Davalas, there were four brothers, had been good, but the Davala brothers somehow didn't hit it off that well with Alfredo Parra. And unfortunately, Alfredo Parra left. I had a very high regard for him. He was replaced by Juan Holguin, H-O-L-G-U-I-N, who was who was then about 68 or 69 years old, an extremely skilled mining engineer and manager who'd spent most of his career with IMSA, I-M-M-S-A. And Holguin took over from Parra in a very smooth transition. I remember in January of 86, on a visit there, production was humming along at 1,000 tons a day. Grade was running better than 20 ounces a ton, and operating profit was pouring in at the rate of $1 million a month. and it improved from there. And the story had a relatively happy ending, because we paid back the loan. Only about 18 months after we began mining the high grade. Whereas we had gotten on well with the Davalas during the lean years, we found that as soon as the loan had been repaid, there was some disagreement about the strategy for the future, particularly ways and means of treating income in relation to Mexican tax liability. Our tax accountants just didn't see eye to eye with theirs. And we decided that the best thing might be to sell out, which we did. The operation was bought by, I believe it was a subsidiary of Cyprus Minerals, and I received some reports that they ran into difficulties with the Dobblers. Again, a matter of communication.
That's sad.
But for us, it had been very exciting and even financially rewarding experience in Mexico. And, you know, people have asked me in times, what was it like doing business there? And I have only two comments. One is that technically these the Mexican team that we had there under our supervision all the time, but they were top-notch, the workforce was productive, and to the best of my knowledge, in our 10 years there was never one penny paid by way of a bribe or incentive to anyone. We made it clear at the outset that we were not going to do that. The word got around, and there was never any hint of bribery or any other scandal.
Sounds as if you had some brilliant geologists.
Yeah, well, discovery of the Alacran vein itself was the result of detailed surface mapping and geochemistry. It turned out to be the richest vein that had been discovered in the field, and the Spaniards had missed it totally.
Mm-hmm. Any people you can name that performed well?
Yes, in the early days.
Maybe you have to look these up later, but it might be nice to mention some names.
But, Steve Potter was a guy who was involved there. But the surface mapping that I refer to was done by, please leave a blank.
Sure, we can fill that in later.
I should remember it, I can't remember.
And this raising from the adit to intersect the...
Well, that was just to make mechanical, that was the obvious thing to do. I mean, mm-hmm. we had to do that.
But you've done the geology.
The fortunate thing was that we interpreted the drill intersections correctly to give us some idea of where the bottom of that high-grade chute, that's S-H-O-O-T.
Yes. Okay.
So that was...
That's a good story.
Bolaños, yeah. Mm-hmm. We enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
The second one that I would like to talk about is Crixás. C-R-I-X-A-S. Which is in Goiânia, G-O-A, G-O-I-A-N-I-A, about 80 miles from Goiás, and 260 kilometers northwest of Brasília. How that came about was that in July of 1981, I went on a trip to Rio to look at the Pocos de Caldos, P-O-C-O-S, De Caldos, C-A-L-D-O-S, alumina plant and smelter of Alcoa, Brazil. We were seriously thinking of getting into the bauxite and aluminum business, and had been invited by Hannah to look at buying their interest in Alcoa Brazil. Well, on that trip, I went to Brasilia and met with Minister Kalls, C-A-L-S, Minister for Mines. I spoke to him in a mixture of Latin and French, and he responded very slowly in Portuguese. And believe it or not, we were able to dismiss the interpreter, and we spent a couple of hours with the aid of a lot of gesticulating and making jokes. We had a very good